Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at Southern films.
What we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men you just can't reach. So you get what we had here last week, which is the way he wants it. Well, he gets it.
I remember when my daddy gave me that gun. He told me that I should never point at anything in the house, and that he'd rather I'd shoot at tin cans in the backyard. But he said that sooner or later, he supposed the temptation to go after birds would be too much, and that I could shoot all of the blue jays I wanted if I could hit them. But to remember, it was a sin to kill a mockingbird.
I'm not crazy, Malin. I've just been in a very bad mood for 40 years.
Whoever you are, I've always depended on the kindness of strangers.
Red, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
My guest today looks at how the South shaped American film and how film, in turn, helped influence the South. My guest today shares his new history on Southern film and how the genre's first great masterpiece during the silent era helped revive the Klan, how vigilante justice as depicted in American Westerns were sly commentary, both pro and con, on the lynchings in the American South, and how African-American filmmakers, shut out of the Hollywood system, made their own films in an underground way back in the 1920s and 30s and distributed them in their own under-the-radar way. These are just a few of the stories University of Tulsa English professor Robert Jackson shares in his new book, Fade In, Crossroads, A History of Southern Cinema. It's published by Oxford University Press. He joins us today to talk about Southern films and Hollywood and the South's influence on each other. Bob, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rich.
Yeah, your new book looks at Southern filmmaking, the history of film and the South, Fade In, Crossroads. What interested you in this particular subject?
Well, I came to it from several different perspectives, actually. I started out as a literary scholar working on fiction and poetry that was produced by Southerners and people like William Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor.
Who had a great history in the cinema in the 1930s,
right.
Wrote a lot of screenplays.
That's right. And that was kind of the beginning of my academic career, and I really got absorbed in the South from the literature. And then I was drawn to history in a very different way because I began to sort of think more seriously about politics and economics, and especially about the racial history of the South and thinking about the history of segregation and the civil rights movement. And, before that, the entire slave era for 250 years and, the Civil War era and Reconstruction. It's an incredibly rich history. It's really U.S. history. And at the same time that I was working on these things professionally, I was watching a million movies. And I've always been a big movie fan since I was a kid. And it eventually struck me that nobody had really put all of these things together in one place and tried to account for the relationships that Southerners had with the motion picture medium when it emerged. So it was kind of a slow process of dabbling around the edges of these topics. And as you say, someone like Faulkner becomes more interesting when you understand that he actually paid the bills as a result of going to Hollywood and becoming a screenwriter in the depths of the Great Depression. I mean, he wouldn't have been able to write his books if he hadn't had some of that money coming from Hollywood. So it became this sort of massive project to try to sort through everything and come up with some patterns and try to understand the entire period.
So as much as Southerners became a part of the film industry, they also had a profound influence on the subject matter of films and what you could depict and what you didn't depict and how you forged Southern stereotypes.
That's right.
And also really big messages on race. How big an influence do they have on the content of what people saw in film in the first 30, 40 years of the medium?
The answer to that is that they had enormous influence on it, but it wasn't simply Southerners producing Southern stereotypes. If you go back to, say, the second half of the 19th century, or even just the post-Civil War period, in American culture. Americans became very enamored of the Old South, as it was suddenly named. There was no such thing as the Old South before the Civil War. But once slavery had been eliminated, this category, this kind of fantasy place, it was tinged with nostalgia. The Old South was created. And magazine fiction and popular imagery sprouted up, popular music, blackface performance. All of these things were really interested in creating these kind of sanitized images of the Old South. It's sort of like science fiction in a way, because it really didn't have any real connection to historical reality. But it was a way of dealing with the complexity of the present. And in the late 19th century, United States was a period of great industrialization and upheaval. The country had lost 600,000 people to the Civil War. Slaves were no longer slaves. They were free. And, you know, the kind of racism and confusion and animosity and political struggle that characterized that period was just so enormous that images of the Old South became a kind of safety valve in a way. They helped people to try to deal with the confusion of the present, right? I think we have this tendency to try to seek simplicity when things get very complicated. And images of the South played that role for a lot of people. So we're not just talking about racist white Southerners who are producing images of the South in which, you know, in many of those stories, the slaves were happier being slaves than they were after the war, after their emancipation. An outrageous idea. But this was a vision of the South that appealed to white Americans regardless of where they were. And then it began to be exported around the world.
I was going to say, did film, though, help forge some of these stereotypes?
Absolutely.
Or did they reflect what the culture at large was?
Yeah. I mean, it's a combination of those things. Without a doubt, the most successful films, the most popular films about the South advanced Southern stereotypes and made them travel and made them more popular in ways that magazine fiction of the sort that I was just talking about could only hint at. And there are a couple of notorious examples of this I'm sure we'll talk about.
D.W. Griffith, for example, The Birth of the Nation. There's just an article in the Washington Post talking about how this movie glorified the Klan, in which, you know, at a time when the Klan was pretty much dormant.
That's right.
And that film, as much as anything, as well as the incident that led to the lynching of Leo Frank, helped revive the Klan. And that film was a major part of that.
Well, The Birth of a Nation is, to this day, possibly the most profitable film of all time. Certainly the most influential movie ever made. And it is responsible for the proliferation of American film distribution around the world. Its success led to the development of major Hollywood studios, including MGM, because Louis Mayer, one of the studio heads, made his money on distribution of Birth of a Nation back in Massachusetts, where he grew up and had his early theater chain before he got really big. The profits were spread far and wide. But at the same time, this was a film whose epic scale produced these stunning images of the heroism of the Ku Klux Klan as a force for good, something that is going to prevent black equality from taking hold and black political participation.
And this was not just a popular movie in the South. It was
absolutely
not. These sentiments were shared everywhere in the country.
When the film was premiered at Clune's Auditorium in downtown Los Angeles in 1915, in front of the theater there were horses with robes and hooded Klan riders advertising the film. A lot of the publicity and the posters outside of these theaters would just feature a hooded Klan rider, and an image of a Klansman on the horse became this kind of iconic figure to glorify, as I say, the heroism of the Klan. As the movie is presenting it, the historical Ku Klux Klan had been basically shut down by 1871 because President Grant got wind of some atrocities, and, you know, the violence of the Klan was proliferating at the end of the 1860s, just right after the Civil War. So he put a stop to it. And that was that, basically, until 1915. And as a result of the film and emerging segregationist attitudes, mainly in the South, but not exclusively, the Klan became a 20th century phenomenon to the point that it came to dominate political parties, even in places like Indiana. The state of Indiana political machine was dominated by Klan activity for much of the middle third of the 20th century. So this is something that really had a massive influence, 100% evil. You know, I mean, there's nothing good we can say about it. And it's so tenacious and it's so built in kind of to the DNA of the film industry that even today we see traces of it that are emerging here and there. It's very difficult, as we know, for people of color, especially African Americans, to get films produced. It's very difficult for entrenched Hollywood production companies, major ones, you know, the big companies, Disney or Warner Brothers or whatever, to actually put big money behind productions dealing with African American topics that question the status quo. And we still have a global model of film reception and film culture that's based on the primacy of whiteness. White movie stars continue to sell movies around the world. Whether or not they're actively promoting a racist agenda is a totally different question, you know, and I don't think that's the case much of the time. But the fact remains that because the studio system was so invested in this model of Jim Crow segregation for so many decades, it's really institutionalized.
And we think of D.W. Griffith as this one film, but in fact, I was surprised to learn that he made, gosh, about 13, 14 films on the Civil War and really was sort of a promoter of this idea of the lost cause, you know, the lost cause of the Civil War, the sort of this alternative theory of the Civil War that it wasn't about slavery when it was about slavery.
Right. Yeah, the lost cause is an argument that the South fought a noble battle, that it was outgunned, mm-hmm. but that its ideals were defensible. States' rights is kind of the most convenient euphemism.
Yeah.
But the idea that slavery was not a factor.
Yeah.
So a lot of the ideological views that emerge from this, such as the view that the slaves were better off under slavery, they were happier, they had been converted to Christianity from whatever heathen creeds they ascribed to previously in the old country, these are all parts of lost cause mythology. And then the sense of sacrifice of ordinary white Southerners who fought in the Civil War. And this is something that emerged immediately after the Civil War. An ex-general named Jubal Early, you know, was one of the big progenitors of the movement. Mm-hmm. And it became this sort of governing creed of white Southern culture for many decades. And there are certainly elements of it in play to this day.
Yeah, you're seeing all sorts of demonstrations over Civil War statues coming down in the South.
That's right. Yeah, the recent one that's just happened here in the last few days is in Charlottesville.
Right.
And I'm following it pretty closely because that's where I went to school, at the University of Virginia. So I know that scene. I know a lot of those people.
And we should also mention one other thing that came up. There's a Smithsonian film about race riots right after World War I. It mentions Tulsa race riot. And there's some newfound footage of Greenwood that the producers of the film purported was Greenwood prior to the race riot. In fact, it was shot after the race riot. And you wouldn't believe the reaction to that. It's not even stated as it came before the – it's ambiguous. It sort of alludes to the fact that it came before the race riot. And there's just been this huge reaction to this footage.
Right.
What do you make of that?
You're talking about some films that were produced by an African-American – preacher and businessman named Solomon Sir Jones, who was a native of Tennessee. He moved out to Oklahoma. I think he was about 20 years old when he moved out here. And between 1924 and 1928, he produced 350 minutes worth of film, just as an amateur filmmaker. And most of it is very innocuous stuff, just filming street scenes, filming church scenes. And it's really kind of like extended home movies, but of an entire community of primarily African-American folks in Oklahoma. And some of it was in Tulsa, and some of it was in Muskogee and all sorts of other towns. And you know the history of all black towns mm-hmm. in Oklahoma, so you know there's plenty of material out there. Well, apparently some filmmakers used some of this film and didn't quite explicitly identify what the sources of these films were. And it's implied, I think a little bit loosely and irresponsibly, that some of this footage is taken of Greenwood before 1921's racial massacre. And that's a problem. I mean, you know, you really have to be very specific and cautious when you're dealing with historical sources of this. I mean, just the same way that you would be careful with written sources or newspaper sure. sources or whatever. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, then we see this volcanic response in the year 2017, 96 years later, by people who still cannot deal with the fact that a racial massacre took place, that as many people were killed as were killed, that it destroyed an entire community, and that there were really no long-term repercussions for it, aside from the fact that the black population of Tulsa was devastated, and there really hasn't been any kind of an effort to reinvest in black culture, black infrastructure mm-hmm. in this city ever since. So the wounds are still there. You can see the sensitivity. You can see the nervousness and the fear that emerges. And you can still see the way that history itself is a terrifying thing to a lot of people, that it represents something that is deeply repressed. And there are just a lot of people out there who, this is probably an element that exists in all of us, you know, this struggle to try to come to terms with reality. And yet it's there. It's not going anywhere. These things happen. They're part of the history of the region. And everybody walking around today is a descendant of those people. And it's just part of our lives. So we have a choice to try to be as constructive as possible, try to understand it as fully, as comprehensively as possible, to really scour the sources and to treasure them, to respect the sources that we still have, whether they're oral histories or newspaper journalism, or in this case, a handful of films from the period. Interestingly, there is one film that exists that has footage from the race riot, and that is a newsreel that was produced by Fox right around that time. I think it was on June 1st, mm-hmm. 1921. And Fox, this is the same Fox of Fox News today. It's gone through a number of different incarnations over the last century. But the newsreel branch of Fox Studios was created in 1919, and they had stringers, people all around the country with movie cameras who would go out and film incidents and try to get them produced. So going to the movies once a week or twice a week, which most people did before television, would be their way of picking up on what's happening nationally.
Other
That's
than
kind
newspapers,
of like watching
yeah.
the evening news.
Right.
So 1921... somewhere in June, maybe a week or two after that, there was a newsreel that actually has some footage. And it's not footage of hand-to-hand combat or violence or anything like that.
Footage of the aftermath.
But it's really the aftermath, yeah. right? The same way that natural disasters are often not caught on film, even today. But then you go see the sort of the devastation afterwards, yeah. whether it's a tornado or whatever else it is.
My guest today is Robert Jackson, Associate Professor of English at the University of Tulsa and the author of Fade In, Crossroads, A History of the Southern Cinema. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And really, in our remaining time, I want to talk just about two areas. One of the things is you did extensive research on how lynching was portrayed in film. And you actually came up with this interesting thing, which most people would not put two and two together, was that really lynching in film was far more portrayed in the West as, you know, the horse thief.
right, right.
But there's this very strong message being sent that goes to the South that when an outrage is committed or outrage is perceived, take the law into your own hands. How did you come about this? And I may be simplifying your theory a little bit.
This goes back to a conversation I had with one of my professors when I was in graduate school. And we were talking about films dealing with anti-lynching messages. There's a movie mm-hmm. called The Oxbow Incident mm-hmm. from 1943, which is a Western, and it features a gang of seemingly law-abiding citizens who go out in search of some criminals, find these three guys and lynch them, and then discover, sorry to give the movie away if you haven't seen it, but they lynched the wrong guys. These guys have been killed. And it's basically a debate about whether or not people should be taking the law into their own hands. And that's in the 40s. And this is kind of during a wave during World War II.
There's anti-lynching laws that routinely died in Congress through the late 1930s and the 1940s.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And so this is a debate that's going on. Even as the lynching of African Americans, especially black men in the South, is a massive and absolutely scandalous, horrifying pattern. Thousands of people were killed. Whether it's in small lynching parties of two or three or four or five vigilantes, or massive spectacle lynchings that could have thousands of people coming to watch, the same way that they would come out for a ball game on a weekend. And they'd actually plan special railroad schedules so people from other towns could come and witness lynchings in some of these cases. Outrageous. I mean, it's one of the worst patterns in American history, certainly in the modern period. And during this period, which really stretched from about 1880 up to World War II and continued beyond that, you know, the famous lynching of Emmett Till took place in 1955. So that's well after World War II. And has never really died out 100%. I mean, there are some recent crimes that certainly fit this pattern, whether you refer to them as lynchings or not. So the question that I started to ask myself was, how could lynching be portrayed on film? This is such a powerful presence in American history. And people in every community knew about it, not just black people. I mean, one lynching within a 50-mile radius of your community, 100-mile radius, is going to make news pretty quickly. That's going to travel. However, it's going to travel by word of mouth, largely, right, if nothing else. And it seemed to me that it really had to be registered in the popular culture and the literature, in the music, in performance and drama and all these cultural forms as well. And so when I started looking for traces of it on film, there are some famous films that feature lynchings, including The Birth of a Nation, right? Mm-hmm. Probably the most notorious lynching sequence in American film history, right? In which a black soldier who fought in the Civil War is lynched for pursuing a young white woman who then leaps to her death in a very melodramatic way off this cliff. And the vigilantes come and get her with their white robes on. The thing that happens after that film in 1915 is that it's largely the Western that features lynching and dramatizes exactly the same situation, except it's not black men chasing white women so much as it is horse thieves,
murderers
or criminals in some largely Western part of the United States that's beyond the reach of legitimate law enforcement.
And I assume you have films that sort of reinforce that, and then there are films like The Oxbow Incident where it's and it also becomes the meme of the lone sheriff facing down the lynch mob or the town that wants summary justice.
Sure, absolutely.
And these become memes for lynching?
Absolutely, yeah. Uh-huh. I think that these are really kind of defining elements of the Western. It's very difficult to imagine what the Western would look like as a genre if you didn't have these lone figures, whether it's the evildoers, the criminals who end up getting lynched, or the vigilantes who are going after them. So it became a very complicated pattern that I was chasing after and trying to identify, in which lynching becomes all American in a way, because the great majority of films that feature lynching in U.S. history are films that celebrate it. They actually represent it as something that's constructive, that it's necessary, that it's a valuable presence, because the police, the courts, the politicians, whoever the city fathers are, they can't get it together, and it has to be good old-fashioned individualism that saves the day.
Interesting.
So it's a very strange twist.
One of the last subjects I'd like to talk about, because this has a little bit of an Oklahoma connection, is you write about independent black filmmaking in the 1920s and 30s, where they created their own distribution circuits because there was no way to distribute films to the big movie house chains and studios that really controlled movie theaters in the 20s and 30s. independent black filmmakers sort of created their own circuits, Richard Norman being one. He was, I guess, white, but distributing African-American material. And Oklahoma towns played a role for Westerns, like in Boley, right?
Sure, that's right. A lot of the material that African-American producers and filmmakers and audiences would have been interested in was simply not going to be produced by Hollywood. It was beyond the pale. Whether it's even kind of considering race as an interesting topic or simply featuring African-Americans in straightforward roles as middle-class people or as cowboys.
Or something other than a stereotype.
Exactly. Yeah. Anything other than happy servants or mammies or, right, some of the mm-hmm. criminals.
Yeah.
Kind of the standard stereotypes of black culture. So very early on, African-Americans who were curious and interested in film began to produce their own stuff. And Oklahoma became a great site for production because of its beautiful locations and the presence of these all-black towns, including Boley, Oklahoma, which was the place that Richard Norman, who was from Florida, took a little crew of people and got some cowboys out there on the spot and filmed them doing their roping and all of their other stuff, and then trying to fashion these things into short films. They weren't really the most accomplished movies. I mean, those look a lot like home movies, too. But they were actually quite successful, and I think the reason why is that black audiences were so tired of seeing nothing but stereotypes, right? I mean, who wants to go to a movie to see, you know, your people stereotyped and caricatured all day long, right? And kind of the hunger for just seeing black culture. It was so powerful that this became a valuable aspect of what they were doing. Hmm. Norman wasn't the only one either. I mean, there are a number of other filmmakers producing black film. And he was a white man who recognized the need for it and produced some stuff that was middle of the road, kind of escapist fare. But the other major filmmaker from the period, from the teens and 20s and 30s, was a guy named Oscar Micheaux. And he really has gone down as the kind of the face of independent black filmmaking because he produced a great deal. He dealt with much more controversial subjects. He produced probably the greatest anti-lynching film of all time. Within Our Gates is the title of the film. It came from 1920. And it almost point by point is a rebuttal to the logic, the racial logic of The Birth of a Nation, a very powerful film. And he really had a racial mission to try to produce images of black culture that were more rounded and more complete as a historical vision than anyone else.
The name of the book is Fade In Crossroads, A History of the Southern Cinema. Bob, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
Robert Jackson is the Associate Professor of English at the University of Tulsa and the author of Fade In Crossroads, A History of the Southern Cinema. It's published by Oxford University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.